You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Culture and Flavor is a podcast about food and culture centered in Black and Indigenous foodways, hosted by myself, Zella Palmer, right here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Each episode features high vibrational conversations with cultural bearers, chefs, farmers, scholars, barbecue pitmasters, and more. Where there is flavor, there is history. Join me on Culture and Flavor and all of my guests as we share stories that will have you praise dancing, cooking, conjuring, and inspiring your culinary journey. Y'all, I am so excited for this episode of Culture and Flavor with Lino Asana, a dear friend of mine. He is a filmmaker currently living in New Orleans from the Cameroon. His films often explore and celebrate themes of Black dynamism, identity, and transnationalism. Some of his films and videos have been featured by OK Africa, Bitter Southerner, Nowness, and Indie Wire, and screened at several film festivals. In addition to developing his first feature film, The Parking Lot Attendant, Asana is currently in post-production on a documentary that intimately explores the contribution of Black chefs and humble cooks in the New Orleans food industry. Welcome, Lino, to Culture and Flavor.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. First, I want to get started with just a little bit about you. I know I explained, a little bit about your bio, but I really want to get into depth of what made you come to New Orleans and just your recent trip to the Cameroon after so many years.
Oh, man. I think much of my work has always been about finding connections in unfamiliar places, and finding, because I like to identify myself, yes, as a filmmaker, but also like this version of a palm wine story drinker, which is kind of like this person that I was raised with that sits in this corner bars, in Cameroon and listens and talks and gossips and speaks and tells stories throughout the day. And so some parts of that and some part of, again, finding connections leans into always, paying attention to little things that come my way. And one of that was when I first discovered the book Creole Feasts by Rudy Lombard and Nathaniel Burton. I was just immediately connected. I really just connected with the book, in that it was exploring some connections and some ideas of things that I had experienced in my visit in New Orleans, but I couldn't quite put my finger on. And he goes into depth about that, and so that was like the genesis of, that led me down the rabbit hole and into the place now that I call home. And it's been great. It's been great ever since.
So let me just give a little bit of context about Creole Feast for our listeners who don't necessarily know about that cookbook. I mean, it is a classic, treasured cookbook in Black food ways, in American food ways, really. And it was written and published by Rudy Joseph Lombard, who was himself a Renaissance man. In my mind, he was the Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier of Black food ways, right?
Yes, indeed.
Brilliant, 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 brilliant. And in the 1970s, he, you know, published this book along with Nathaniel Burton of these 15 Black master chefs in New Orleans. And if we wouldn't have that book today, we wouldn't know who were the master chefs of that time period. And it's just, it's a treasured book. And he did so much for the city of New Orleans. I mean, I could go on and on. You all can look him up later. Lombard versus Louisiana, the Supreme Court decision that integrated the lunch counters in New Orleans. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what else can I say? You know, Lino, take it from me.
I mean, you know, there's this, I'm trying to frame something with this book being Nathaniel Burton sitting in the front. You know, the very first image you encounter with this book is Nathaniel Burton in the cover. Mm-hmm. And immediately you're thinking, wow, for me at least, I was just like, I've never seen a chef that looked like me, that looked like him, that looked mm-hmm. like this. You know, if that doesn't grab your attention, I don't know what else will. And as you start to look into that, you're diving deep into something so unique to American foodways and Creole cuisine in general that is just not been explored before. And as you said before, this is a book that came out in 1970s, mm-hmm. at a time where there was one, no, you know, there was, this is probably the first book written by a Black chef that was focused in the ways of, you know, with the recipes and the stories that are coming from our perspective. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was anything like that before. And mm-hmm. for others that might not know as well, this book was edited by the great, I'll let you say the name of the person that edited the book.
Toni Morrison. I mean,
there you go.
What's Toni Morrison? And I can't wait for your documentary to come out, because you shared with me a clip that you found of the moment that Toni Morrison came to New Orleans to visit Rudy Lombard. And there he is, his fine self back in the day. with a beautiful smile, just waiting and, you know, hugging Toni Morrison to invite her into this, you know, this Creole feast. And I remember just, you mm-hmm. know, just a side note, just talking to him about why he wrote that book when he was alive, you know, and just mm-hmm. he wanted mm-hmm. to lift these stories up. And you are doing something similar in the 21st century and lifting this story up again. Could you mm-hmm. talk a little bit just about, you know, the documentary process and, of course, your Black Chef series?
Yeah. So with the film and its inspiration from the book, we are, you know, you fast forward to now and some things have changed. Well, a lot has changed, and in some good ways and in some bad ways, meaning some things just didn't change at all and they should have. And one of that is, you know, when many people come to this city, this great city, one of the things that seems to be a mystery for, you know, for strange reasons, is not knowing who's behind the kitchens and who's cooking in behind all these kitchens and great restaurants in this city. That was the case then, and in some ways, that's still the case today. This film kind of invites audiences to meet this unheralded Black chefs of New Orleans. It's kind of an intimate, intergenerational portrait that reframes acceptable culinary, you know, the acceptable culinary histories and explores this ingenious contributions of Black cooks who brought traditional food ways from West Africa to the New World and who continue to shape this iconic and enduring Creole cuisine. You know, Creole Feast follows all this new, this chefs, line cooks, and back of house workers as they balance honoring the traditions of their elders and charting a new path for Creole cooking. Mm-hmm. You know, and some part of that while I was researching at Discovery, I just couldn't find as many photographs as you might think. Because I come and you come and we start talking about the story. Okay, you know about the book. Someone knows that, you know, they've never read this book before. And their perception of what the history of this, you know, the history of the food waste in this city, you know, it differs in many ways. And so I found it a lot. I found a lot of walls trying to find just some visual representation of who these people were, you know, and what that time was. And what you will find is some of the photos in the book. And you start to ask yourself, and maybe one of that became a task with some, you know, some of the, you know, friends I've been working with. One of my best friends who's from New Orleans, Josh Ferrier, who we had this conversation of, you know, this is great talking to these people while we're making this film. I'm getting to meet all these, you know, all these great folks in the city and chefs, and we're talking about their talents and they're reflecting on their experiences and history. And you start to feel like, well, you know, just this conversation itself, there's something historic about it. Now, I guess say I fail at making this film a reality. Mm-hmm. It seemed really important and much easier to maybe start to take some photographs of these people while we're doing this. Mm-hmm. How can we take some portraits? And so when you say this name, there is a face that goes with it. Mm-hmm. To not allow anyone to start to imagine that this isn't real, this isn't real people, and these stories are kind of made up. And to approach some of these things from the journalistic perspective is, yes, you're recording it. Yes, you have the video part and you have the audio part. But man, to have the photo is a different thing on its own. And I was, if I fail, if I completely fall to the ground and I'm not able to complete this, because I'm also a tourist, and there's a danger to that. So I was just like, you know.
I'm going to make sure you finish it. I'm going to encourage you every day. Well, you have a whole community that's behind you to make sure that you finish it.
Exactly. So you say you might need some Capricorn energy to take some photos, you know. And because they might actually get some shit done. And So we gathered at first. This was in 2017, I believe. 2017. No, it wasn't 2017. It was 2019 because we started this project in 2017.
Okay.
We said we were going to gather as many Black chefs as possible and bring them up, show up at Congo Square, and take a few photos and see what, you know, just to document and archive. Archive really being the most important part of the whole process. To build this archive, really, because one of the things I really discovered, and that wasn't, we weren't really thinking about that then, but we realized it after, because we had a good amount of chefs that showed up and took some photos, and it felt great. And some of these people had never really met each other, they've met before, but they've never really been able to just talk because they passed each other for the past 10, 20 years in the quarters, just in the morning, 6, 7 a.m. You say hi to this other chef you've seen because, you know, you got the uniform and the hat. He's got the uniform and the hat. It's like, hey, you've been seeing each other for 20 years or so, but never really, really had the time to have a conversation because you're going to work. And as we know, chefs, you know, once you leave home and you're getting close to work, you got a lot of stuff to do. And so they were all having these conversations and talking and really catching up. And that felt really beautiful as one part of it. And so fast forward again, post pandemic, we decided to try that again. And that really leaned more heavily on the idea of, you know, archiving even more aggressively, because when we shot what we did in 2019, about 3 or 4 of the chefs all passed away by the time we were trying to do the second one, the third one. Mm-hmm. And so you start to say, okay, this is really, really important. And it's built itself up to be just a part of the project in a very different way. And I'm very happy about what we've been able to put together so far, and for all the great and beautiful artists and chefs and all people, you know, involved that have come together to make that possible. And we hope to continue doing that if we can, you know, every year or every other year or so going forward.
Could you give us just a preview of some of the chefs that you highlighted, maybe a few of their stories?
Of course. Well, we talk about the great Nathaniel Burton, and I think of him as the godfather of Creole cooking. Mm-hmm. I think this is someone that was, he was the executive chef at Broussard's and a few other places. I would say for folks to go and look into him, and specifically read into the book to go deeper into his background. But he comes into how to paint someone like Nathaniel Burton is someone that really breaks down what the skills are for you to be a great executive chef. You know, for you to do the numbers of running about 4,000 people or so a day, for you to train a chef to understand every piece of meat by just looking at it, you can pick a piece of chuck and be able to know exactly where, you know, what part of the cow it came from. Mm-hmm. You know, to be able to use every instrument and, you know, all the tools. And I say instruments just because that comes onto a general word when you start talking about Black chefs in New Orleans. It plays really well into how they are able to be just as close to the practice of jazz musicians. So good at what they do, in a way
that's
that
a great analogy,
right? In a way that is just it's magical, but it allows me to take 2-3 steps back into some of the greats, like the great Chef Lita Richards. I'll say I'm probably butchering the name, because in New Orleans, when you say Richard and everything, it gets real specific over here.
So it could be Richards or Richard.
Exactly. So anyone forgive me back there, if it's just, they're concerned about how I'm pronouncing some of his names. But, mm-hmm. you know, that goes to someone that, like, who had one of the first, this is before Julia Childs. You think of Julia Childs, Lena Richards comes before her, and that she had a first TV show mm-hmm. and was a great caterer and had the book the New Orleans Cookbook, which I think if you are local or beyond, you should find a copy of that as well. And you go into folks like, Chef Leah Chase, which we had the honor of, I had the great honor of speaking to and interviewing for the project before she passed away. And I like to talk about, I'm highlighting a lot of the women primarily, and because for obvious reasons, because much of why I got into this was inspired by, you know, my mother, who is an amazing cook, and I grew up with her stories and her cooking. And much of all the male chefs I've spoken to, they all attribute their inspirations from their mothers in some shape or form. And so as you start to go back, you start to see this lineage of women that came before, all the way back to, you know, to Gory Island, where the slaves left my country, to, you know, the ports here of New Orleans. And we talk about the Black Hen in the Pot. Okay. And I had a great time in one of the kitchens, which is not around anymore, and that's the Bonton Cafe. And there was Dot Hall, you know, the head chef, and there was Willina Benjamin and Joyce Owens. And I swear to you, in that space, it felt like you're in this TV show that These women have all been in that place, and they've been working there for over 40 years, mm-hmm. close together, and just exchanging stories and going on and on and creating, and just there's this joy in the room and doing what they love to do and what they've been doing for so long. Mm. And it's a beautiful thing to experience because, again, once you sit in these restaurants and you're getting all this food, I think it's in some ways it's a service for you to ask yourself who made this food. I think we live in a time where things have become so automated that the idea of a real human being making your food seems like a foreign concept. And I think, you know, I'm not the most religious person, but there was a time where when you were, you sit down to eat, you know, the first thing you did was a prayer, and some part of a prayer always was to thank the person, thank the folks that made the food. Maybe somehow along the way we've shifted away from religion, which I can understand. But there was something really special about you taking a moment to thank the person that made the food, because in that moment, you're thinking about the person that made the food. And we don't do that as much anymore. I find myself thinking about that, and that I find myself not thinking about that more often than before. Because we've gone away from eating on Sundays with our families to eating alone at home from some food that was delivered by Uber. I think that's as we do that, we should do some more work to look into the people that make our food, because that's really what this is about. It's about shedding light on, you know, the great chefs, not just in New Orleans, but, you know, in the Carolinas, in New York, in mm-hmm. Oakland, and other places far and beyond. So.
Ooh, this is a powerful first half of the episode. And I just want to thank you all. I want to thank you all for listening thus far. And we will be right back after a word from our sponsors. And we're going to talk with Lino Asana a little bit more about Creole cuisine in New Orleans, his roots in the Cameroon, and how that's connected to New Orleans, and the character of his film, Chef Lazone, as well. So we'll be right back after these brief messages. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So tell me a little bit, you were briefly talking just about how how we are kind of disconnected from our table, from from saying blessings and the rituals and traditions that historically have brought us together in communities throughout the generations, throughout the decades. And it's something also that we brought with us when we were enslaved to, like you said, the ports of New Orleans, and that idea of lagniappe, that idea of Southern hospitality is really rooted in, you know, West African and Central African principles of community. So I'm just curious, you know, what are some of the, your observations, just you as a Cameroonian looking at Creole cuisine, and why is it so important And why is it so integral to American cuisine?
I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what is American cuisine? And the great Dr. Jessica Harris have pointed or created or written a great deal about us finding some connections and identities of where this food comes from the Black, from this perspective that we're talking about and more. But to me, one of the questions, one that was the main question for me is really, what is American food? Because if we're talking about burgers, if we're talking about lasagna, we're talking about, you know, burritos, you know, what are we talking about?
And is Creole cuisine American? Is it American?
I think that is the answer to it, is that what is the original? What can we really claim to be something that is uniquely ours in the sense that we're so good at remix. We do a really good job at remixing foods and taking other foods and making them better. Creole food kind of falls to me as like you said, like for me, Cameroonian food is Cameroonian food in so many ways and so many specific things that there's probably, I'd say, 60% of the food that you won't find anywhere else in the world, maybe more, right? That's uniquely just that cuisine itself. And so coming from a perspective and identity where your food identity is so specific and so solid in that way. And as I came here as a, and when I was, I got here when I was 15, and so I'm eating all this, I'm eating this, and I'm eating pizzas, which took me a while, eating a burger took me a while, eating, you know, some of the foods now from some of my, my Black friends, and that I was meeting later, I start to eat, you know, some greens here, some mac and cheese here, some, you know, the list goes on, but I start to find some similarities and connections, but it's not till I got to New Orleans and then you try some Creole red beans and rice, which is very similar to our Black beans and rice. And cooked almost exactly the same way, which is weird. You know, it's very weird to me. I never encountered that before. And you have your gumbo, you have your jambalaya, which is like our jollof, and then you have your beignets, that's just like our puff puff, or, you know. So you start to, the connection is, as you are from a California perspective, from a Cameroon perspective, California perspective, and you're shifting closer and closer, and you get into the South and you get into New Orleans and you start to taste these things that are closer. It's like this circle is connected at the end of it. And you're starting to see this path that is just connected directly right to your heart, to where you came from by just eating the food, you know? And so to me, American food is Creole food. American food is, you know, barbecue. American food is some of the great dishes you'll find in the, you know, Gullah Geechee parts of the Carolinas. You know, beyond that, I don't know what the hell is American food behind those three things and a few others, but that to me is, that's where it seems like our folks have been able to really stand solid and say, this is where we will express ourselves, you know, with what we know and what is, you know, what we can maybe explain or break down, but it's just inherently like a thing that is, you know, is glued to you like it's like a callus over your heart in terms of your culinary identity, you know. But yeah, that's kind of what I think. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, absolutely. And I'm, you know, I want to talk also about Chef Lazone, you know, a retired chef in New Orleans. I mean, he is a character. You know, and you've developed a beautiful relationship with him, and it was beautiful to watch you all together when you invited me to a recent event that you hosted.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, you know, just some of the things that he, you know, shared with you about just the contemporary state of Creole cuisine. And, you know, he, I remember he served this incredible gumbo, you know, and I haven't tasted a gumbo like that in a long time. And I'm just curious some of the, you know, your thoughts after every time you leave him, you know, what do you take away? You know, and who is he? Chef Lazone, for those who don't know who Chef Lazone is, because we have many chefs like that in New Orleans, our elders who are retired, who are walking encyclopedias of recipes. And I always think about one person in particular, Chef Stanley. He was in the Creole Feast, and it always broke my heart that I wasn't able to, you know, film him and document him in time for his death. But he won, you know, he was in the Culinary Olympics. He was the head chef at, you know, the Hilton Riverside. And there were so many like that. So what you're doing now is so important in archiving just this generation before we lose them, you know. So talk to us about Chef Lazone.
And Chef Lazone is, I don't think it's fair to ever compare anyone, because I think each person is very unique to who they are. But we started talking about Nathaniel Burton and how, when you think of an executive chef, what does that mean? What does that look like? And I think another person that embodies that really well is Chef Lazone Randolph. And the trip of, I mean, he's just someone you want to put a cowboy hat on and put a camera on him and and give him, you know, and
just let him
put
roll.
Just let him roll. And I swear, you know, put some pots. You know, have some fire somewhere, and a bunch of people, and you know,
he'll tell you everything you're doing wrong.
He'll tell you everything you're doing wrong. Exactly. That's if there was a great like Duane's like cooking show, you know, man, yeah, the things he would say to what people think of each dish and what they're doing and how much and how we're all, you know, how many people are failing and what they think Creole cooking is and what cooking in general is and how, you know, Chef Lazone was the executive chef for Brennan's, and he came under Mike Roussel, which is another great black chef. And like all of them, they walked their way up from dishwasher, learned each station. And when the time came, when Mike Roussel was leaving, and one of the things I admire about Lazone is he's got the bravado of like 10 people and the confidence of, you know, he's just got a great deal of confidence that's packed into him, packed up into his, you know, into his character. And the question that I'm asking the zone is, okay, Mike Roussel left. And at this time, mind you, Mike Roussel is probably the only black executive chef, the only Creole executive chef in New Orleans at that time. And there goes this 6 foot, you know, dark skin, you know, chef, which I think at that time he was in his 30s, early 30s or late 20s. And I was saying, did they consider you to become the executive chef? And he was like, well, if they weren't thinking about me, I'm leaving. I was going to be gone if I wasn't going to become the executive chef. You know, he's saying I didn't go asking for the job. Mm. You know, it doesn't work that way. He has a great deal of respect for Microsoft. But the idea of it not going to him and going to someone else, which happened sometimes because some of these institutions would bring in some other chef from out of state, he was saying that was not going to happen. And this is someone that speaks with that kind of confidence. You can tell how he speaks on it. That's just how he was then. This is still how he is now. Meaning I deserve it. I've worked hard. I've worked hell and hard for it. And if you're not going to give it to me, then I'm out. You know, that's the kind of personality that's the kind of person he is. He's someone that's going to, you're just not going to ride over him. And that goes into how he, you know, his ethos and how he works and how he approaches the food. He loves it. And, you know, he can pick up all the books and go right deep into it, learning as many new things as he can. That's how they all were at that time. Just the excitement and interest of, cause you had a time where you had all these French chefs that were popping into New Orleans. And they're all looking this way with the French flag, you know, next to their neck, with the, you know, wrapping their, you know, the handkerchief on their, you know, there's this like swag that just appeared into the city at that time. And I think some part of many of them wanted to be just as great as some of these French chefs in terms of technique. Mm-hmm. And they opened themselves up to learning. And to learn meant you're dealing with 12-hour days. But one of the biggest things I'll say Chef Lazone has left, one of the things he said to me that really resonated with me is he made this statement that the once upon a time, there was just no ACs in this kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't cool to be a chef as it is now until they put ACs in the kitchens. Mm. Mm. And so if we're all thinking about that for a second, it's like New Orleans is very, very, very hot. Mm-hmm. And for a while, all these chefs in the kitchen were dealing with heat, no AC. Well, now you got TV shows, you got all these people wearing the poopy white, you know, vests, and they're doing all this and doing all that. And the idea of a celebrity chef is this. And, you know, let's think back to what a kitchen was at that time. No AC. You're making the souffles that are how many degrees, super hot, burning yourself. There's heat everywhere.
And considering that the kitchen was predominantly African American.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it, what he's trying to say is that it's, you know, it wasn't cool for you to be a chef until they put some ACs in there. Then you all of a sudden you say, oh, this is a cool job to have. Maybe I can do this. And everyone starts flocking over there. The pay increases, and you know, a lot changed in terms of who's back there, who's in the front. Mm-hmm. And who's the executive chef and who are the cooks? Oh, now you got black cooks and executive chefs that are white. And then they get to parade in the front and claim and state that these are the dishes, these are the things we're doing. And not to say there weren't some great white chefs. There were. Mm-hmm. It's a really difficult job, despite your race. I'll say that, you know. But what we're talking and exploring when we're talking about these people and these chefs is recognition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but yeah, sorry, I interrupted you. What you were saying?
No. I was just saying, you know, just to support your point. I remember, I think I told you that I was talking to Don Hubbard, one of our elders who, you know, has a beautiful hotel, man, you know, Airbnb, not just Airbnb, but it's a beautiful home where on St. Charles, and his paran, as we call it, say in New Orleans, you know, is godfather. His paran is actually in you know, Creole feast, and he was talking about how he would have to, you know, wearing that chef suit also was in some ways kept you protected from the police.
Yep.
And, you know, when he would have to go work, you know, as an executive chef, you know, he wouldn't get harassed, because we have to remember Uptown New Orleans was not a friendly place, you know, up until the 70s. And so, you know, and how he had trained some of these top chefs, these top white chefs, and hoping that he could get an executive chef position, but he never did, you know. But he was the executive chef in so many ways, you know, he was the executive chef, but they never publicized it. So now, you know, what are your thoughts about just Black chefs, young Black chefs in New Orleans? And, you know, is Creole cuisine that is it dying? Is it a lost art? You see any chefs that are, you know, kind of taking the rein back to say, no, this is our food. We need to, you know, continue to put out the recipes that our elders put out.
Yeah. An attempt of what you attended was the dinner where we were putting together, you know, some young chefs next to some, you know, some OG chefs like Lazon. And even during the process of taking some of his photos, portraits, you find a good amount of the young chefs show up, and some that just graduated. It's strange because the times we've done it was not strange. The times we've done it, there's been at least 2-3 chefs that showed up that just graduated that week from culinary school. And I'm always interested in what do they look like? Where would they be 10, 20 years from now? Because it's like they're showing up when that's like you seeing a photo of Nathaniel Burin on the day he graduated culinary school. Which he never did go, but is an example of that. What I've noticed while talking to the many, you know, chefs here, young and old, is that it's just the love of it, the love of the food is there because the identity is so strong. I don't see Creole cuisine going anywhere. Necessarily. What the unfortunate part that I think we could lose is there is some things to technique of, you have someone like Lazon, you have someone like, you know, Chef Dot Hall, or, you know, like the chef Leah Chase, and all these great chefs before, and some still around. There is some level of technique because you've been doing and cooking these dishes for, you know, 40, 50 years. And, you know, it's the elder thing, right? In my culture, it's, you know, it's like that thing where, you know, once we lose one elder, that's like a library that's just burnt to the ground in a way. What I find missing is, if you look in the book Creole Feast and you look at some of the other books, what you see there is a great deal of technique. That is a part of Creole cooking inherently, but what some of the young chefs know from cooking at home and what they learn from some of the culinary schools they go to me just 40% of what the food actually represents and what it actually is. Because there are some things that are just, you know, just recipes and things that are just disappearing. And you can read the recipes, but the techniques are strange and different because chefs, it's specifically Black chefs, they don't focus too much on breaking down recipes in the ways that that you can say, okay, I'll copy that. I'll do it exactly as you, because they can write that recipe and do it four different ways. What you're trying to learn when you sit and stand, when you stand next to them, like Lazone and some of the young chefs did in November when we had the dinner, is you see them do these things in so many different ways that are not written in any books. And I think that's what we might miss, and what that's I went to a restaurant in New Orleans, I won't say the name, with another chef of one of my great friends, Chef Serene, which we both know. And we were talking about the menu of this place that's been around for, you know, since, you know, for a while, for a very, very long time, in a way that defines parts of what this food and cuisine and city is. Now, you would think that this is a place that will protect and keep some of these ingredients, some of these recipes and processes intact. But what we had and what you might have had 4 years ago at this place, and what is being given to you from a chef's perspective, they can tell 3-4 steps were skipped. Right? You're making this dish one way, the right way, 4 years ago, and out of a sudden you've decided to skip a bunch of steps. And some part of that problem is the new chefs don't know how to make it the way it was made 4 years ago. That's not a long time. And that's unfortunate, that it's starting to look like it's leaning that way, where this thing, some of these dishes that we eat and enjoy and love might change just because some of the chefs and some of the younger chefs are, one, not interested, as interested in being chefs as they used to be, or the process of doing it is just for some reason that they seem to justify as just they can't keep it up, they can't train, there's no one to train them to make this food the way it used to be. Some of the chefs have retired and some have passed on. And I think that is a real issue that we, are all facing in the city, that might not be very loud as of now, but it just might be later, because there is foods we eat at home that you feel like, oh, well, that's not going to change. And that's true. But there's so many more that are on the menus of some of the restaurants you really love that just might change because, well, there's no one to train them to make them the way they used to make them. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And I think that, post-Katrina, it had a lot, the faces, the people who were being hired in the kitchen changed, and so you have chefs from other cities who don't have that Creole repertoire. And then also, the further we, Americanize, the younger generation get used to processed cheese or fast food or Walmart, the further people get away from cooking a lot of those, classic Creole dishes, there is no food memory,
That is, that's an important factor for all of us, even if you're not from New Orleans, just the idea of your food memory. Mm-hmm. In my recent trip, I got to go to, to parts of revisiting some of the places, the home I was raised in and my grandmother's place. And one of the things that struck out to me is my grandmother's kitchen, which is, the kitchens in the village and the kitchens at home are very different. And the kitchen in the village is, 3-stone fireside with a cast iron pot on top. But there's this thing I had forgotten, which was there's sort of like a little cage made out of bamboo sticks, and it's used to smoke the fish. And they keep spices, but it's predominantly known to smoke fish and sometimes to dry the corn that was harvested. and you're seeing all these techniques and these things. And I was talking to a friend of mine about what his memory was here in New Orleans, and what did his pantry look like? Because these ideas of what a kitchen looks like to us, and what the kitchen looks like to us now, like our kitchen, and what does our parents' kitchen look like at that time? And you start to find these things about it that that is beautiful, but also they are, you know, heartbreaking in terms of what you're doing and what they were doing and how things have changed in one of the ways. But to even go back, one of the things you mentioned, which I want to bring out too, is just the labor part of what it means to, you know, to be a chef with that. New Orleans is, you know, it's got one of the lowest minimum wages in the whole nation. Mm-hmm. And with any real issue in any place, if you start to pay attention to the money, a lot of things start to become very clear. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not seeing a lot of Black chefs and Black cooks and whatnot in, you know, in the service industry as well, the pay is too goddamn low. And absolutely, it's not sustainable. And one thing that beats me is, okay, you have some of these institutions and that have been around for so long, and you've made millions and millions of dollars. I'm sure you have, because you've been around for so long. And I know it's hard to run a restaurant and, you know, business. But I don't think it's that hard to pay people living wages. That just absolutely beats me. And it's the most heartbreaking part to this whole thing is to exploit people in a way when it comes to an industry that is so intimate. Mm-hmm. In that you that own the business are so connected to these people, or at least you pretend that you are.
Absolutely.
And the people that are eating the food are so connected to the people making it, or that's what it seems like it is, you know? And you know, what I talk with one of the chefs, another great chef here in the city, Chef Milton Prudence, who still works at, who's still around to, you know, still cooking and at it. And he's one of the things he's really excited about is teaching. But also one of the things that breaks his heart is the idea that you would rather hire a chef or cook from out of state than to send some of your workers, you know, to some extended training. Because if you sent them to extended training, now you have to increase how much you pay them for. Mm-hmm. So you'd rather keep them where they are. You know, mm-hmm. And I get America is a capitalistic society, but, you know, some of these things, and some of these things when you meet some of these chefs, there's one, another chef that I've got to know over the years, and as you know, Chef Ernest, you know, call him Skeeter Jack Jr., and he's one of the executive sociers at Antoine's. Mm-hmm. It broke my heart when we first sat down with Skeeter, because his voice was so low. So low, mainly because of the reasons that he's been yelled at so much over time that his voice just sunk down that low. And it's not to say this is a grown elder that is in his 80s. It's not that it wasn't there. It could be for many reasons, of it just being a very emotional day for him. Because one of the things he said to me, as far as long as I've been doing this, which is, you know, 40 years, he started when he was 16 years old. No one has ever sat him down and say, hey, how did you get here? What did you, you know, no one has ever asked him that. No one ever put a camera in his face and said, hey, not that you need to, but he's been back in that place for that long. he's someone that should have been an executive chef, but it's suiting and it fits an institution to keep him as an executive associate.
Yeah.
Why the executive part? Oh, here's another title that I'm going to slap on there to make you sound and feel good about what you're doing. But you're doing the same damn job. You're getting paid the same amount I was paying you 10 years ago or so.
Hmm.
Now, a lot has changed, I would note. Two, 3 years later, I meet Ernest again, and his mood has changed. He's more confident. He's speaking a little louder. He's a little taller.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had increased his pay. Mm-hmm. You know, they had, you know, I don't think they had changed the title, but something changed in him when I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him why. And he said it could be that the executive chef that was there left. But it also could be that we came and spoke to him and then they were like, okay, maybe we need to start paying more attention to you.
Mm. Mm.
40 years later, it takes someone to show up there for you to recognize. But that's just all to say, like, yeah, the labor part of this industry is very difficult, yes, for the people running it, because we are our friends that it's difficult. It's difficult to balance because the younger chefs today, they don't want to do 5 years in your kitchen as they used to. They're very interested in starting and expressing themselves and finding their own thing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And mm-hmm. so you have to get real comfortable about the idea that they might just be there for a couple months or a year. Can't mm-hmm. penalize them for wanting so much more for themselves.
And you can't.
No, you can't, you know. So it's changing, and in a good way, I think,
mm-hmm.
just for the fact that they are more bold and curious about their identities, and they know they cannot explore those things inside the space of another institution. They rather start their own pop-up, say, hey, this is the food I want to make. This is the food my grandmother used to make. This is the food that I'm thinking about mixing with this other food because that's part of Creole food. I had an interesting conversation with Chef great granddaughter of Liuche's, Chef Zoe.
Just say that I'm just so excited for their, they just released their latest, show on Legacy on PBS.
Yes.
And
yes.
So I was there for the launch and to see them making the dishes that they were making and the personality and the generations on the screen, it's going to be a game changer. And I'm just so excited to see that. But to see that happen, to see Doug, Zoe, to see Eve, you know, Cleo, you know, Aunt Cleo, I'm so excited mm-hmm. to see the Chase family because they are going, when I tell you this, they are going to be a national phenomenon.
Yeah. I'm so excited. I'm so excited for that as well. It's just this, Zoe's got this sparkling, like sharp excitement mm-hmm. and curiosity about mm-hmm. the food. And that's kind of what we were, it's great to just see this new energy and this generational perspective of what the cuisine represents. And that's one of the things I'm excited about the show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it's putting a huge spotlight on what we're talking about, which is Creole food, but also to just the history and the story and what it means and breaking some of the misconceptions others might have. Because I think to really see something is difficult for you to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think what that show will represent is that, no, you can't ignore, or you can't be ignorant about what the food represents and who the people who have been a great part of it represents as well, you know? So I'm excited.
Absolutely. And to see Duke and Zoe in the kitchen together on the first episode and then making dirty rice and Creole chicken and you know, just some of the techniques that you were talking about earlier that are not in cookbooks, to see that on screen was profound. You know, it made me tear up because, you know, both of us knew Miss Leah and to like see her grandchildren, you know, just take on what, you know, what Duke said, you know, his latest restaurant, Chapter 4, the fourth generation, is so powerful. And I think it's going to really inspire other chefs, you know, and no matter where they take it, you know, if they decide, like you said, to open up a pop-up, open up a restaurant, because we do see a rise in Black restaurant ownership in the city for that simple reason, because they want their own. Or if they take it to another city, we see a lot of chefs, you know, move. I can remember talking to somebody about, how the Atlanta scene changed after Katrina, the restaurant scene changed and food got better. And they, and somebody told me they believe because New Orleans chefs moved to Atlanta and brought that, you know, flavor with them. Right. So, you know, it's an interesting time, you know, and I'm glad that you're able to document this and, you know, and for it to be a living archive.
Yeah. To add on quickly to one of the things that one of the things Leah would say, Leah would say is food builds big bridges, and I find that what they're doing is doing that. I find that in so many of the ways that some of the young chefs are exploring, you know, themselves and the food, because Chef Zoe was saying, we were kind of laughing at her, you know, her aspiration of the idea of opening a Creole food in Italy, and how weird that is, that part of the food that, or the places, some of the foods that are the identities of Creole food, whether that is French, so it can be on the south side, you know, the southern parts of France, and have Creole food, you know, it just have Creole food in those places. And I find that to be beautiful, but that's where, though, that's where her mind is going. Is this like, let's just, you know, back to where it some of the inspirations come from, and beyond. One of the things that I'd like to point out too, if you in terms of the bridges, in terms of the food expanding out, is when people go and Google, remind people to Google this. If you Google, chicken lasagne, you know, that was recently brought to the attention of Chef Lasagne that he created that. And it's been on the internet for a while, for a very long time. And that is his recipe that just popped out into the internet, into the abyss, into this universe, and is floating around. And it's got his last name to it and will be around way beyond. And that is this strange rendition of Creole food just extending itself again out into the space. But you know, it's funny when the many people who've cooked that dish might not have known where it came from. And you know, but for the few that might have, it's still a beautiful thing. And even if they didn't, it does not matter. It's just that's what I think Chef Leo was talking about, is that, you know, food, you know, builds bridges. You know, she would add on to say, I don't care if you're the Pope, you're the Prince, you know, you got to eat. And if I can feed you, then I got a job.
Right.
And, you know, so, yeah.
My exciting last question. It is exciting times. My last question, just, you know, you thinking about your identity and place in New Orleans and just your own upbringing in the Cameroon and, you know, living in California, like you said, you know, there's always this saying that New Orleans is the most African city in the U.S.
Yeah, indeed.
Does that remain the same? Is that still the same today? I'm just curious. What makes it the most African city? if you believe.
I think it's, you know, it's that smell when the rain falls and it hits the dust, and you get this whiff of this smell, and it's so unique and specific, and it's I think there's this visceral feeling you get that you cannot explain. And I think sometimes, to me, the mysterious things about anything for me, you know, is it leans towards like smell. Smell is just a mysterious thing. And I use smell to say New Orleans smells like Africa, or smells like my country, Cameroon, as opposed to all the other things that are very clear, just because that idea of it, smell, is the most mysterious part of it. But to demystify the whole thing, it leans really well to what the culture represents, what culture means, and what community means to New Orleans. And I think it's the one place where post-pandemic or pre-pandemic or whatever, I was trying to decide, you know, where is my spirit going to feel very calm enough for me to focus on my purpose? And it's loud in every other place. As a filmmaker, you're from, you know, that lives in Oakland, everything yells, well, you got to go to LA, you know. There's a difference, just like your heart and your mind. You have to face those two things. And so if you're really listening to your heart, it's like, you know, you start talking and leaning towards, how does your spirit really feel? How would it feel in a place like LA? How would your spirit feel in a place like New York? Not I got any problem in New York or any of those places, or Chicago, whatever. But I had this really, I had a lot of ache for home, because I had not been home since I was 15. And I couldn't really kind of go back just yet, because that was the year. I had one more year to become an American citizen. And that's a whole nother story to go into about the reasons why I couldn't go back home at that time. And so the only place I could think of that made me feel like home, whether because of the food, which is you got your red beans and rice on Monday, and you eat that, and it's the same, and it takes me to this place, which my spirit just becomes, you know, it's walking on grass with your feet without your shoes on type of feeling, you know? And so I feel that way in New Orleans. I know I only feel that way back in my country, Cameroon. And so it was just very obvious, you know, for the sake of your own sanity, the sake of your own spirit, the sake of you keeping to do what you love to do so much, you know, it's without no doubt that this is the place that your heart just feels at home at. And I can't explain it. I just can just say, yeah, it smells like home. It feels like it. And I love it. And I got to go back home last year. And that just, you know, the senses are just stronger, is to say the most, you know.
I think that's what makes Dakar Nola's Juneteenth celebration last year at Ben Burkett, the Mississippi African American Farmers, you know, celebration so special. It's just, you know, the bridge between the continent, New Orleans, Mississippi, you know, everybody who was there, even had folks from the Carolinas there. And just to see us, you know, in this space telling our stories, but definitely grounded in where we are and the legacy of African Americans in this country was profound, you know.
It's like it's the energy of the despite it all kind of energies, despite this, despite that. We survive and we thrive and we celebrate and we're going to dance on Sunday and you can try again with your troubles or your bad energy or your attitude on Monday. But this is the tipa that will cleanse all that up by Sunday. That's like the old, African proverbs about the mosquito and the ear, and how the mosquito really loves the ear and declares its love for the ear, and the ear laughs so hard and says, you know, look at you, you know, you look like a skeleton. How long you think you're gonna live? And the mosquito walks away sad and disappointed. And that's why a mosquito always comes back to your ear to whisper, hey, you know, look at me, I'm still alive, you know. And and we laugh at this. I think what I'm excited about with Juneteenth, the concept of just celebration, is just, yeah, to celebrate. Because one of my approaches with the film in general had always been about just the idea of celebration. I'm not interested in some expose thing about this and that and that. I'm interested in celebrating these people. I'm interested in celebrating us. And there's a beautiful joy in centering our stories in that perspective, and because it's, yeah, you know, it's got a feeling to it. I try my best to always lean that way when I can, when it comes to the work.
Well, we thank you so much, Lino, so much for your work, for everything that you're doing to document and tell these stories. These stories need to be told. So we want to thank you for joining us on Culture and Flavor. We want to thank our listeners. You have listened to Culture and Flavor with Zella Palmer, with our special guest, Lino Asana. And we look forward to hearing more about your work. And we cannot wait until the documentary and the film is out. And, you know, for more information about Lino Asana, where can they contact you?
You can contact and look into the project on the Creole Feast, www.creolefeastlegacy.com. That's where we'll be keeping updates. And as we continue to, you know, do this work, and whether that is the archiving and the completion and completing the film. So, but thank you so much for having me speak on this and speak to you. This was great.
Thank you, Lino. And I will see you Juneteenth.
I will see you Juneteenth. Don't bring your shoes. Keep that shit.
No, I'm not going to bring my shoes. We're going to be on the farm. Grow that.
We're going to be on the farm. Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Thank y'all for joining Culture and Flavor. We're out. Peace.
All right. Peace.
Culture and Flavor is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.